You're listening to Spilling Ink.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Spilling Ink Live. We are the talk show that takes you behind the scenes in the indie publishing world, where we talk to authors and publishers and cover designers and pretty much anyone we can. This week, we are here with me, the beautiful Jason Lavelle, of course, your head host, Katie Salidis. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
She stole that move from me. We have S. Elliot Brandis. He's over there. He's smiling. He's the beautiful man with the beard. And then we have Daniel Arthur Smith, who is having some technical difficulties at the moment. So who knows when he will be popping back up, but he should be back with us shortly. So S. Elliot, are we calling you S. Elliot, or how should I address you?
You can just call me Elliot, Jason.
Elliot, I like that. I like that. So what is it that you write? Tell us a little bit about what you do.
Well, my most recent novel is a horror novel, straight up sort of dark humor and horror. But before that, I sort of wrote, I guess, across the board a little bit. So I've got a trilogy of post-apocalyptic novels, as well as a standalone young adult science fiction novel. But I'm trending more towards horror these days, as I'm sure Dan can attest with my submissions.
Can you hear us, Daniel?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Fantastic. I think I'm back, like a 90-degree turn.
Good. We can actually see you this time, so that's good. So, Daniel, tell us a little bit about what you do. You have this huge list of author credits, but that's not all you do. So tell us a little bit about who you are.
So I'm an author. I write cross-genre. I've written adventure thrillers. I've written horror. I've written pedestrian literature. That's a new term I heard Anne Rice say, other than just literary fiction. Pedestrian realism. Yeah, that's what I write, pedestrian realism. And then I also curate and produce Tales from the Canyons of the Damned, which is a pulp fiction magazine that's been out for just over a year now, where we just put out our 12th regular edition this weekend, and we have two omnibus and another on the way. So that's what I do as far as writing. And apart from that, I'm a fuller time, but I'm an at-home dad. So that's one of the reasons I'm sequestered now in the west wing of the house, while the children are in the east wing playing video games. And that pretty much sums up what I'm about.
That's awesome.
The west wing of the house versus the east wing. I was gonna say.
Well, this house does. Our apartment in Manhattan is just like one wing. So
I was going to say, when you have an east and west wing, you've done something right in the world.
Yes. What is your secret?
just honest work and being nice to people. You know, it pays off.
Oh, that's awesome. So, you know, for those of you who have been on the show before, I write horror and paranormal stuff and, you know, pretty much anything that'll creep me out and hopefully other people. And Katie, you write kind of a little bit of everything. What are you writing right now?
Right now, am I allowed to talk about it?
I feel like we're allowed to talk about whatever we want since it's our show and we're live, so they can suck it.
All right. Well, right now I'm working on a super secret dragon anthology that actually Jason's part of, too. And we're hoping that one's going to be out, I think we said April, in time for Phoenix Comic Con.
April 1st, yeah.
Yeah, so we'll have that one out and in print when we actually do the convention. But other than that, normally I write anything paranormal. So it could be paranormal romance, could be paranormal thriller, dystopian with a little paranormal twist. I always have some other element to what I'm writing, depending on which genre I want to play in.
Awesome. Now, Elliot, you have something very big going on today that I am super jealous about, but it's also very exciting. Tell us about your BookBub success and what you have going right now.
Yeah, so I've got a book club promotion running today, this very day, this very moment. I'm very tempted to check how it's going, but I won't. As of 15 minutes ago, it was going very swimmingly. So if anyone else wants to go in there and buy a copy of Young Slasher, I'll do it now while the going's hot.
What kind of sale do you have going on for the book pub?
So it's a 99-cent sale of Young Slasher. So that's the horror novel I was talking about before. So it's a very old-school slasher movie-inspired, with lots of black comedy and all sorts of shenanigans and
okay. And
so it's good fun, but it's got serious parts and it's got some really dark humor. But I think it's my most enjoyable novel. So I'm very glad that it's getting featured today, and hopefully, fingers crossed, it all goes good.
That's awesome. What attracted you to the darker side of fiction?
I think enjoying the darker side of fiction myself. And so when I started out writing, it was very post-apocalyptic stuff, which is, again, if you want to make it a little bit more bearable than just straight up end of the world stuff, you've got to include that dark humor. And I think, again, that's that kind of style of dark humor where things go terribly wrong. Is actually, you know, done a lot in horror and in horror movies these days, where they almost make fun of their own genre and their own tropes while in the movie itself. So I think it's just a natural fit for me.
Oh, excellent. And for anyone watching, I actually just posted a link to Young Slasher right on the Spilling Ink Facebook page. So if you pop over there, you can click right on it and check out Young Slasher. It is the one with the fantastic cover art of this cool claw drippy hand with blood coming off it. It looks pretty badass, actually. And I have not read it, but I'm really looking forward to it. So now tell us, because we want to know more than just about the book, how in the hell did you land a book club ad? How did you get that?
I don't know. I don't know how it works. So I've submitted multiple times in the past, and you know how it is. You never get the good news. And then, it was around about my birthday, so just before we went out to Machu Picchu, I just on a whim thought, I haven't done one for a while, I'll submit. And they got back to me just before the new year, and I was lucky enough. So I don't actually know how their inner machinations work, but it's worked in my favor this time, so I won't complain.
That's pretty fantastic. And you went to Machu Picchu for your birthday. Did you hear that, Katie? He gets to go places.
Crazy. Beyond the walls, what, how do you do that?
Right? Do you not have kids yet, or do you have kids?
No, I don't have kids.
Oh,
step number one, kids.
Well, I thought you're not the only one who's a world traveler, though. And I don't know all of Daniel's cool stories, but from what I understand, you've kind of done a bit of globe-trotting yourself, haven't you, Daniel?
Yeah, I had the opportunity to do some globe traveling before I had children. See, that's a pre-children activity. I thought that I would continue with that once we had kids, but you know, the first one like tired me out, and the second one just beat me down. So we're kind of waiting before we try to do anything else. But yeah, a little neat rundown that listeners might appreciate. So I was working in Three Rivers, not that far from where you're at, I think, Jason. I was making the commute from Kalamazoo, and I was working for a software company, and they had just started putting these things called PCs into medical care, long-term care places. You know, people didn't really have a lot of PCs in their homes. This is the 90s. And since I had a background with those as well as mainframes, I had myself a pretty good job. And then what ended up happening with that company in Three Rivers is they sold to the competition Futon in the office, and it cost me a lot of just a lot of sacrifices, relationships, those things, you know, when you're working around the clock. And you know, nowadays you would make a business plan, you incubate something with the idea to sell. But in the 90s, it was the idea that you were going to, you know, end up on top. So to have our program be sold to the competition was just, it just broke my heart. And you know, our claim to fame is we were the first in like Windows 3.1, and everybody else was in DOS. If, kind of give you an idea of how ancient this is. And so once that sold, I decided, well, I didn't want to just keep taking care of their stuff as they phased it and made it disappear, which is why they bought it. They didn't even buy it to upgrade. They disappeared. So I decided I'd go over to this job interview. So I went to where Whirlpool is, just south of you, Jason. And I went down, and I was in what's called an immersion interview. We were there for 8 hours, and they hand you off every half hour to a different manager. And, you know, maybe one half hour, they're asking you what all these terms mean. And the next half hour, they're asking your experience. And the next half hour, they're asking what you do for your hobbies. It's just go, go, go. And I drove out of there, and I was looking at all the houses that kind of looked the same with 3.2 kids and in an SUV and a sedan. And you know, I had a philosophy degree. Cognitive. The whole idea was just a car that I bought with when I was at the company. And I tried to sell. I sold everything I owned from Kalamazoo, gave the rest away. Was supposed to sell the car, couldn't sell it. So I drove out to the airport in New York, drove through Canada, New York, tossed the keys on the front seat, and went in with what was at that time called an air hitch ticket. And that's back when plane tickets were like a punch card. And you could, for $100, they would UPS you a voucher ticket. And it was a standby ticket, essentially. So I went in, and I was supposed to fly to Luxembourg is what the standby was. And I got in there. They said, well, no, there's a big storm. It's a 100-year storm in Europe. There's no Luxembourg. So I said, when's the next flight going out? And they said, well, there's a flight going out in 20 minutes to Madrid. And I said, put me on it. And so that was – so I disappeared for a while. And ended up journeying through Spain and France, Germany, lived in Prague for a while. And all through Europe, did a lot of traveling then, ended up living down in Crete for a while. It was a pretty outstanding time.
Well, that is fantastic. Now, when in your journeying, did you first start getting into writing?
Well, I've been writing since I was in grade school. You know, when I came back from Europe, I opened a coffee shop in Michigan. And the idea was I had this small cabin on Lake Huron, and I was going to write there. So I wrote a couple novels there that no one's seen here, because at that time you had to package them up and send them out. And I just never put them into digital format. I probably will one day, but now I have, you know, 17, 18 years of experience on that. So I feel like they need to be totally rewritten. But yeah. The only place where I didn't really get a lot of writing done was Prague. When I was in Prague in the 90s, you know, the wall just come down, and it was a very exciting time. And it was full of Americans, for one thing, but it was full of all these people that were playwrights and artists and musicians and writers. But the reality was is that a beer costs the equivalent of an American nickel. And, you know, that's where Pilsner's invented, you know. And then booze is, like, super cheap. And I was managing a bar because that's the best job I could get there, and working for a .com. It's a whole other story. And so basically, no matter what you said you were when you went there, when you were there, you were drunk. And so I left Prague because after 2 months of just being flat out soaked, I decided if I wanted to actually get anything done, I had to go forward.
Oh, man, that's awesome. See, the single life. That's excellent. And that's where you're still at there, Elliot. Now, have you been writing your whole life as well, Elliot?
My life's a little bit shorter than Daniel's.
But mine too, just a little bit.
Brandis is my younger uncle. I just think of him as that traveling uncle, traveling Brandis.
I'm just sitting here jealous. I don't think I've ever really done any traveling.
Have a chance. That's the thing. I think Brandis is smart to go out now. I've been to 22 countries, over 300 cities. Some of it I did, you know, at that time I told you about, but since in my career, the corporate world, I spent a lot of time in airport. If you can get out to places while they're happy to see you, that's the key thing.
I think I'm stuck until my kids are grown. And then yeah. I will get my traveling done.
I don't know. You know, Heather and I have talked about, and I actually posted in our little group chat there, Daniel, that, you know, we're talking about maybe getting the hell out of town here in a couple of years when my next oldest graduates high school, and maybe going someplace tropical and doing the expatriate thing, and I don't know, just getting out and seeing more of the world. You know, the more I see of the suburbs and the cities, and it's kind of like, oh, you know, we have a good life. You know, things are comfortable, but I just want to see something different. I want more. I'm kind of like the Little Mermaid, and I have this perfect little life, but I want to be where the other people are.
Jason, you've just given yourself a new nickname. You're now the Little Mermaid forever. That's it.
The Little Mermaid.
I'd make kind of an ugly mermaid, but so Daniel, can you tell us a little bit about building an anthology? You know, what does it take to create these things?
A good friend like Samuel Peralta, who's been very successful at it. Then you just kind of sit on the floor in front of him and you know, look at him all beady-eyed and say, you know, first and foremost, as a small indie imprint, I give credit to Sam. Sam, of course, has also been kind enough to work with me in Clones, the anthology, which I put out last year. And he's also been a contributor of poetry to the Tales from the Canyons. The big thing about putting together an anthology is, I mean, there's the obvious parts where you want to find a good rapport with authors that can produce, you know, a continuity of quality stories that readers want to read. I mean, that's where the Tales from the Canyons, which is essentially a pulp magazine, is different from something like Clones, where you're recruiting people not just based on their story skill, but on their platform. It's a lot more about story and person. It doesn't matter as much. I mean, we have some people with some pretty strong platforms. I don't want to make it sound like that, but that isn't the main focus. The main focus is to be able to put the with that said, that, you know, the challenge is Amazon's ever-changing rules, reaching readers, you know, putting these volumes out in a timely manner and keeping everyone involved. And that's kind of the nutshell. You know, it's something we do with Tales and with Clones, a little bit different than a lot of indie anthologies, is we pay up front. A lot of the indie anthologies say, hey, you know, put your story in, here's a contract, and you know, you'll get what we make in 6 months, or you'll get a set amount after the anthology earns out. So we're taking a big gamble, if you will, to pay up front. Other things we've done is we've adjusted the price point. Now people can get box sets, with 10 fantastic new novels last year. Samuel Peralta's in that, PK Tyler, myself. There's so many great authors, and it'll be 22 books, and it's for 99 cents, and it's all original content. So how do you compete with that? Even if you have 3 to 5 excellent short stories, you know, the best we could do is keep that price point down to 99 cents. So that's probably the biggest challenge, is navigating the business side. I think what we're going to see with that, though, with the anthology, is, you know, I've been mentioning magazine more, and Jason, you said you were kind of surprised to hear that, because we don't think of it as a fiction magazine. But by, you know, I hate to get caught up in labels, but by defining the product properly and defining the brand properly, we can go a lot farther. A lot of that has to do with Amazon, not just the readers. But readers that already see the series may notice that starting last month, we started putting a little stamp in the upper corner with the issue number. And that's, you know, that's all part of doing business as it exists today.
Now, with those anthologies or you're using them as individual magazines, how long are they up and available for people to read?
Now, that's a great question, Katie, because something we do with indie, almost all the indie anthologies, whether anthology or a monthly fiction magazine like Canyons, is our payment, even though we pay up front, is lower than what the trade standard is. So the trade standard is 5 cents. I take that back. It's now 6 cents a word, up to a cap. I don't remember what the SFSW, the Science Fiction Writers of America, does for their cap. But pretty much the going rate for any anthology is between $150 and $300, either as a set amount, or the Tales, we pay 3 cents a word up to 5,000. So one of the things that authors are able to get with that in an anthology is all we're purchasing for that amount is first rights for an exclusive 3 months. So that's the indie norm, a 3-month exclusive. Then authors are able to take those stories and, if they choose to, resell them or release them as their own. For example, Bryce Walker, who's a very popular Amazon author, she had an excellent story in, there. What do you go back time and see yourself and do it again? And so the story was called Splinter. And so Clones did very well. I was very thankful about that. But then because of her platform, she re-released Splinter as a standalone. And as far as I know, it's doing quite well also. Now, I should note with that, someone who has a platform like Risa, I'm so happy she's worked with Clones, and I'm happy that Uncle Brandis here has worked with Tales, because these are authors, you know, Brandis you included, that don't necessarily have to share their platform. But a great thing they're doing this for is for the fans. So, you know, like Splinter, back in this case of Risa, that story probably wouldn't have been created had she not had an opportunity to showcase it as a little separate one-off, because she's a novelist. And this was a story from a certain character's perspective that the readers usually wouldn't be able to receive. And it was a very popular character. So that's why the story did really well. So this is where indie anthologies are serving that benefit to the readers too.
Okay. And even after your 3-month exclusivity period, those Canyons issues are still available for people to purchase, aren't they? Or do they disappear after that 3 months? Are we frozen? Oh, I'm
sorry. Yeah. And then, like, any. Are you back? You're back, right?
Yep. I got you back, like, now. We had a little bit of a delay.
Okay. So, like, any fiction magazine, we put together omnibus every X number of issues. So today, for example, I saw that we moved 500 already before starting this interview. But the first omnibus, which has the first five issues, so that's Canyons 1-5, Canyons omnibus number 1 is free today to anybody that wants to grab it. It's never been free before this week. This was actually a promotion that I put together kind of tribute Brandis on his book bub. I'm so impressed and pleased that he received it, and also in honor of this interview today. And so we want people to be able to get that omnibus collection, get an idea of what type of stories we write, and ideally they'll go forward and read the rest of the issues.
Definitely. You know, and I'm actually going to go find that omnibus right now, and I'm going to post it up on the Spilling Ink page and probably the next 60 seconds or so. That way, anyone who's watching, if you want to check out Tales from the Canyons of the Damned, which is fantastic. I loved it. I'm actually in the most recent issue, which I'm super excited about. But that way you'll be able to download some free stories and, you know, get more good free reading for you. So I'm going to go track that down right now.
Now, Jason, what story did you submit to that?
I actually submitted a story called Utopia, and it was funny. You know, Daniel was just saying, you know, he has a lot of people that are novelists on here that are creating short fiction to be featured in anthologies like this. And as he will tell you, I really have a hard time writing things that are short. I really do. So this story is about 3,000 words. So it's a quick read. You could read it in, you know, 15, 20 minutes or so. And it's just kind of a creepy little horror short that's also got a science fiction type of twist to it. But so I'm going to find that omnibus. I'm going to post it right now. But yeah, it's fun. This anthology was the first anthology that I've actually ever been a part of. You know, Katie and I, along with a few other authors, are working on our fantasy anthology, and that'll be coming out in a few months. But I've been super excited to work with Canyons, and I don't know how the other ones work, but I was really impressed that, you know, Daniel said, okay, you know, send me this story. And so I sent him a story, and we had a little bit of back and forth with him and then his editor, Jessica, and, you know, got the story polished up. And then next thing I knew, there was a contract and money waiting for me in my email. I was like, holy crap, this is awesome. You write something, you actually get paid for it. So it's kind of nice that there wasn't a huge long waiting period.
So to be fair, Jason was accepted. A story was accepted back in October. We did a Halloween edition, which actually Brandis happens to be in that edition with Michael Hicks and Samuel Peralta. And that story was voluminous. It was around 12,000 words. And so essentially it just couldn't fit in a slot because, again, to get the price point down. But it was a great story, and that story is going to appear as an anchor story. I want to say, I don't have the schedule up ahead of me, but you're going to be reading that story as anchor story in, I think, C15 or 16 in April.
April? Okay. Oh, that's going to be awesome. And that was...
that time. Before it comes out.
Yeah. Now, Jason, did you tell us how you found him to begin with?
You know, I found Daniel through a woman who is... I feel like she is instrumental in promoting and helping indie authors throughout Facebook. And her name is Alicia Myers. And
yes.
I don't even know how I met her, but she is phenomenal. And, you know, at one point, you know, I asked her because she posts so much in different groups. You know, I'm really looking to try to connect with people on some collections, some anthologies. And she was like, give me 5 minutes. I'm going to set you up with some people. And Daniel was the first person she recommended. And she's like, you really need to talk to him. And he can kind of walk you through what it takes to get going with this. But yeah, that's the coolest thing about the indie community, I think, is that there's so many people that actually want to help. You know, they're not just keeping their secrets to themselves. You know, these people really want to help you. And I'll tell you what, it's been a cool thing. But now, what about you, Uncle Brandis? How did you get connected with Daniel here?
Oh, good question. I don't know, Daniel. I contacted him at some point, but I can't quite remember why, saying I've got this story. I think it would be a good fit for Canyons. And it was maybe, I want to say, after the first two issues of Canyons had come out.
So well, we've been published together in Doomsday, I think.
We did, yes, yeah. So, I mean, I know of you. Everyone knows of you in the indie community. But I don't know what made me approach you. I think it was just having read the early editions. And I don't know, I'm quite forthright. I guess I can send stuff on. And I was glad enough that you liked it.
Oh, I'm so glad you participate on the roster. You're one of our stars. There's no doubt about that.
It was a story called Bloom, which is not something that I normally write these days. So it's about a young girl, I want to say 12 years old, and she lives on an island. And it's sort of like a magical realism take on child sacrifice and the price of knowledge. And it's quite, I guess, literary in a way, but... often with my writing, I like to be quite out there and not trying to be, you know, pretend I'm the smartest person in the room, but you know, rather be try and be witty, try and be funny, try and be entertaining. But for a story like that, it was a bit more wistful and it was a bit slower paced and it had a nice payoff at the end. And it sort of fit that weird space where it's not really fantasy, it's not really science fiction, but it's both of them at the same time. And I think that's what Canyons does really well at is those creative slipstream takes that you're not necessarily writing for a set market. You're writing for all the crazy things that are going on in your head that you need to get down on a page.
Yeah, there's a wide variety in Canyons of that too.
And even just like jumping from one omnibus to the other and reading the same author's stories, you'll see a range. And the authors in Canyons have a lot of range, so it's you never quite know what you're going to get when you open an issue, but it's always going to be entertaining.
Now, you have your first, I think it's your first three, or is it first four books, are kind of a dystopian series, is that correct?
Yeah, so I started with a trilogy of like dystopian post-apocalyptic novels set in my hometown in Australia, hence the ridiculous accent.
I was just thinking that I would like you to come here and just read to me at night.
I'll do an audio.
I'm glad I got my wife out of here before she heard you talking because.
Oh dear, it's I'm burnt, so I can't blush, but it's all good.
So they were set in your hometown of it's Brisbane. Is that Brisbane?
Yeah, so it's on the east coast of Australia, and it's a god-awful hot kind of place. So the whole idea of the novel is not picturing what happens at the end of the world, but picturing what happens after. So it's, you know, 100, 200 years after, you know, the cataclysmic events that ruin society. And it's a lot about, you know, dealing with survival and the increasingly harsh environment. But the first novel, by the way, it's called Irradiated, which probably gives you the idea of what's going on there. So it's a lot about the radiation of the sun and the way that it can warp the bodies and minds of the people that don't stay sheltered from it.
Okay. Now, I recently read, and the book's been out for quite a while now, but The Passage by Justin Cronin. And I thought it was fantastically written, you know, beautiful prose. And his was set many hundreds of years after, you know, cataclysmic events that, you know, ended up destroying the world of humanity. And so I thought that was really interesting because most post-apocalyptic fiction that I read is, it seems like it's boom right there thereafter, and they're kind of dealing with the aftermath. Yeah. So that's kind of a neat take on it.
And I think, like, even Walking Dead and stuff has just propagated that kind of style as well, where it's, you start off at, oh, shit's gone wrong. And then, you know, you get right into it and things are slowly breaking down. But it's quite interesting to come back after things are broken down and then congealed back into a different form, whole different society structures and people and challenges. There's a novel called The Chrysalids by John Wyndham, English writer who wrote Day of the Triffids. And it's one of my favorite books of all time. He originally intended it as like a young adult fiction, but I think it stands up the test of time as like a adult literature piece of work. And it's a very similar sort of thing where you don't actually find out what quite happened at the end of the world. And that's almost the first challenge we're trying to overcome with this style of post-apocalyptic fiction, is that people want a big info dump at the start. They want to know what happened, you know, give me the timeline of everything that happened in the last 200 years. And in reality, if the people living in that time don't know, there's almost like a whole kind of build-up of myth and lore that not necessarily relates to what actually happened, and what actually happens not really important to their day-to-day lives anymore. So it's an interesting sort of twist in the genre.
Okay, I like that. Now, in Brisbane, you said you're on the east coast of Australia. So is that out where the great white sharks like to swim around with all the surfers and stuff?
They're not too bad on the east coast. So I grew up in a city called the Gold Coast, and it's like a surfy kind of place. And then I moved to Brisbane for uni, so it's about an hour away. And there's a lot of beaches around there, not so many sharks. They've got shark nets and all sorts of things that kind of prevent the sharks from eating all the tourists because that's their main industry.
I was going to say, you say not too bad. That means they only pick off a couple people a month?
Just a minute. I think it's slightly worse on the other side of the country, so in Perth on the west coast. They've courted controversy with some of their shark management techniques. I don't know, Australians have a weird thoughts about sharks in that the government started a shark culling program. Anytime they saw a shark within a certain distance from the shore, they'd essentially go out and hunt it down. And people don't like that. So there was a big kind of backlash and environmental protest to save the sharks, essentially. Even though they occasionally eat someone, we don't really wish them harm.
I think that we kill many, many, many more sharks than they could ever kill of us.
And I think, you know, you're in a country where everything wants to kill you in some way. If you kill them back, there'd be nothing left.
Daniel, are you taking selfies over there? All right, so Katie and I and a couple other authors, I think we mentioned, are putting together an anthology of our own. What kind of methods do you use to promote canyons that seem to work for you? Because you told me once that your readership, you usually have, you know, a couple thousand people somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Okay, so what are you doing to get the word out?
I have to say, Canyons, and we've been very fortunate about this, is a bit of a enigma. That this Kindle book actually sells a lot of print copies. And without being in any stores, as far as I know, I haven't put any out anywhere. But I think it's largely to do with the retro pulpy covers that, well, I think it has a ton to do with the covers that we put on these books. People want to collect them. And that in itself, I think, has helped. You know, every time one comes out, Canyons kind of started as just a side fun project with myself and some of the other authors on the roster, just to put some of the short stories we had that were too small to put out by themselves. You know, Amazon readers aren't always very kind. If you put out a story with 1,000 words, 1,500 words, and then charge 99 cents for it, because of the reason we discussed earlier, they can get 20 novels for 99 cents, or at least a full novel, or a great book like Young Slasher. Get it now. So apart from just sharing with our Facebook feeds and our Twitter, I've never paid for a large promotion or any type of big promotion. It's all been word of mouth. But I think it helps. I have around 50,000 Twitter followers. So, you know, when you tweet a cover, found, and the same idea of Instagram, that when you just tweet a post, unless you're a certain celebrity president-elect, people don't really pay a lot of attention to it. But if you put some artwork up that grabs the eye, it's going to do just that. People are going to look on their phone and say, hey, what's that? And then that leads, of course, to sharing, you know, and I had a lot of success with Clones the Anthology. I think that was largely because of existing platform and newsletters. This is an enigma, an anomaly. People see it and they want to know what's in there. And that's why in the evolution, we started with just putting like the names of the stories. And I'd like to think that our kung fu with the covers is getting just a little bit better with every issue.
I definitely think so. You know, you post a lot in the Canyon Peeps group, kind of our group chat with all the people who are involved with the Canyons. And, you know, Daniel's always posting new cover revisions, and, you know, he's getting feedback from some of the other authors in there, like, okay, well, I love this, or I don't really love this. And every time you post something new, it becomes better and better. And this most recent one, you know, the one that says Jason Lavelle on it, I just think this is, you know, the coolest cover ever.
Yeah. Well, I think that's no small thing. You know, that's with any project, the readers see the final version, whether it's your stories or whether it's, you know, the cover artwork itself. And one of the reasons why I stay interested in the Canyons is the rapport with the roster, but also because it is there's give and take. There's a lot of feedback. You know, we work together in a small segment of the indie community, although other authors are welcome. But, you know, around once a month, I barrage the feed with covers. And so when people see that final cover, they're like, wow, this is great. But they didn't see the first few that maybe weren't. So, but it's a lot of minds pulling together to make these improvements. And I'm, you know, I'm happy to get some of the credit for that because I'm driving the Photoshop bus a good part of the time. But there has been in the past, and I'm sure there will be in the future, contributions from the roster to you know, for the artwork itself or pieces. And you know, the same thing goes with the stories. I, you know, it was mentioned that you know, Brandis said that Alicia, or was it you? You said Alicia had talked to you. Right. Yep. And Brandis said it turns people as well. But, you know, we have some great readers and some great support that way. That gets the name out, right, along with the covers. But also the people that have come in, we have yet to reject a story. And that's not saying that everybody's turning in a gem. People that get involved, you know, this is a master's class, you know, and some of the students are farther along than others, but we're working to have the participation of the authors on each project to do not just editing and the idea of cutting things, but making improvements. So I don't just have a reader author first with some suggestions, and sometimes they take them and sometimes they toss them. But then we go to Jessica West, our editor goddess in chief, And she has taken stories that I thought were finished, were excellent, and they've gone around with her and came back. And you're like, wow, yes, that just went to 11 or 12 on a 10, on a dial of 10. And without this whole team working together, it wouldn't be the quality product that it is.
Well, and what is it that you always call it? You know, one thing that you said to me, I think you said it, it's not a collection, it's a collaboration with people. And
oh, it is. And as people put in more stories, I think of yourself, because I know you have a few coming in and working, us all working together. It is a collaborative attack on literature. We're gonna make people look and see that this is a great way to do it. I mean, we have a genre that, you know, I call it dark sci-fi and horror. You know, that genre doesn't exist as a genre. You're supposed to be science fiction and fantasy or horror, or this, you know, but I think the cutting edge, right, I wanted to see, you know, with the Twilight Zones and the Outer Limits and Night Gallery. You know, they also want to see it with Black Mirror. And of course, I'm referring not just to literature there, I'm referring to, television media. But these are stories that don't necessarily have to be horror, but they are going to be Slipstream. And Slipstream in itself is a story that's given the magical realism where we're introducing some fairy tale type reality into today's reality. You know, with Slipstream, it's a story that's going to make you feel strange. Something. Now, in some cases, it is a bit more slam dunk, like in our Halloween issue when we had some body horror from Michael Hicks and from Brandis that just, you know, probably didn't want to make you look at any food for a while, right? So that's like kind of hit you over the head strong stuff, right?
Well, that's a disturbing edition.
Yeah, the theme this month, disturbing. But then there's other stories that are just surreal escapism. And the collaboration is really what's going to make a difference and make a dent and push this forward. And, you know, I mentioned that Twilight Zone and Rod Serling, he's great. But, you know, Rod Serling also worked with Little House on the Prairie and worked with the Waltons, too. And people don't think about that. People think of Rod Serling as just like the Twilight Zone guy, and they wrote those episodes. But he also wrote episodes cross-genre. And so it's about being willing to reach out and put your hands right through the ribs and into the heart, you know, wrap those fingers around the heart of your reader and then just massage it with your thumb, you know, and maybe you're going to get them jumping out of their seat, or maybe in this issue, because of the effect of the stories, your story Utopia, you know, it's something that pulls people in. And when they get to the ending, it makes so much sense, but they're definitely going to sit up straight. And Will Swartstrom has a story called Repulse that's in this month's issue. And, you know, you just might shed a tear, you know. It's gonna move you, because these are analogies of what we're facing in society and life every day. You know, the themes, I have to write little descriptions every month so the readers have an idea what we have. But the line that I try to stay away from, because I can say it for almost every story, is this is a story about the human condition. This is a story that's going to reflect where do you fit into humanity? Every story.
Yeah. Well, and even with the stories that seem like just all out, you know, straight horror stories, you know, I think the first Canyon story of any kind I read was Blower. And that's because one of the guys in Canyon in the Peeps group chat was talking about how much he really liked his story Blower and how strange it was for him to write it. And I read it and I was like, wow, this is, you know, a really creepy graphic horror story. But then I was like, but you know, it actually made me feel a little bit too, you know, it felt deeper than what people would think of as, you know, slasher horror or anything like that, something that doesn't have substance. But, you know, and I like that. I like how you describe that, you know, being about the human condition, because really, regardless of what the genre is, if it makes you feel something, if you can relate to it, then that's going to be good art. And I like that. So.
It is. I mean, well, it's levels and layers. So the other thing that we do in the Canyons that readers appreciate is it gives, like I said, it's like a grad school. So it gives, maybe already novels or a novel series or a voice that the platform knows, but it gives them a playroom, a sandbox where they can experiment And you see, so, I mean, I've done it myself. Brandis has done it since he's here, I'll say. But you see people taking the opportunity to write something like Blower, even from Will Swordstrom, that you wouldn't probably have seen written anywhere else had Canyons not been there. And I know that because Will's told me that. He only wrote that story because there was a forum to play with that idea, which is a little scary because he's one sick individual. You read Blower, right?
Yeah. I say, I'm not going to say it wasn't disturbing. Oh, yeah. Well, and I'll tell you, I would have never written the most recent one, the Utopia, if it hadn't been for you. And Daniel sent me a message. He said, hey, you need to write something short in space. I was like, all right, I'll try. But it's funny.
Well, that is funny, but that was very much on purpose. Is you had started writing a space story, and I said I wanted it short, and you sent me a message that we're at around 15,000 words. Slow down.
Yeah.
This is a good skill to have. This is something that you need to have kung fu for, because even when you're writing a novel, you think about some of your favorite novels that weren't just pulp, that were interesting. These little changes of direction or these little sub stories that still move the greater story along. They aren't just noise. It isn't just like, why did they put that there? It's a little subset of the bigger picture. And that's with some of the short stories I'm doing. And in fact, in this last issue, I have Off-World Kick Murder Squad. And that is actually a sub-story for my Planes world, which is the idea of second realities, multiple planes, not alternate realities where there's more than one of us, but just different spectrum dimensions. So you think of like a bee can see colors we can't see, and a dog can hear sounds. So with Lovecraftian idea of harmonic resonance, it's the same type of experimentation that was done in the Philadelphia experiment with a submarine. They tried to make it disappear by just moving it off spectrum. And so I have one, basically says, we've solved that through some type of discovery, how to get to these next planes of existence that aren't astral planes necessarily. But in getting these other planes, things are tied together that we thought were fiction before, that there really are, though those things you think you see out of the corner of your eye, they are there. And now with this harmonic resonance, we can see them more clearly. And maybe we're quite shocked at what we find. So that's a way that we can add to that. Up till the, Kindle, unless you were an author of some breadth, Stephen King used to do this. The Stand was the short story first in a pulp anthology. And even The Gunfighter, he appears in fantasy and science fiction back in the early 70s, going through a small canyon where he runs into some vampiric nuns. And that doesn't show up in the whole Dark Tower series. But these are places where you can, experiment with character, experiment with your world, build out your world, or just experiment with form and function, with dialogue, with action. It's a great opportunity.
Oh, I agree completely. And I feel like just my brief relationship with you thus far has really changed the way I approach fiction. I'm working on I finished actually, it's currently in review, a fantasy story. It's, based around dragons that Katie had asked me to be part of an anthology with her. And I'd never written anything like it. And they're saying, okay, well, 30,000 words is our goal for every author. And I go through and I write, I'm getting 26,000 words. And then I went back through, and without even thinking about it, I'm cutting out chunks of sentences and moving stuff around. I'm like, well, I don't need this shit. I don't need that. And all of a sudden it's down closer to 20. I'm like, what the hell has happened to me?
But see,
I usually add stuff, not take it away, but
more. We want you to hit the 30,000, so you're going to have to add some more back in.
I know, right? I'm going to have to add some romance into it.
Well, there's something to that. So our friend Sam Peralta, who's in the Canyons, he's written the Future Chronicles. You've never read a novel from Sam because he is the expert, the samurai, cutting things down and shortening sentence in poetry or even short stories appears poetic prose. But now he has a challenge that he has a novel due in a couple months for our Dominion Rising. And this will be the year of the novel for Sam Peralta. So I'm really, really curious to see how he ends up, you know. So yeah. It should be fun. I think a lot of people are kind of waiting on the edge of their seats, a little pressure on my buddy Sam, but to see how, if he can actually come up with, you know, 50,000 words.
That will definitely be a challenge for him. He's a talented dude, man. That's for sure.
It is a whole different beast, though, trying to write, you know, either condensed or trying to expand if you, you know, normally write shorter works. So it's definitely a skill you have to practice at.
What's all that noise I hear?
Well, I think some advice.
Yeah, that's my kids fighting in the background.
So I think that's some advice we can give to any writers that are starting out wanting to build a platform. You know, one of the reasons why I got involved with the Canyons with my friends is I didn't put any novels out last year. I wanted a year of just working on that short form fiction. And indie really brings short form fiction back, and it's putting it on people's laps again, you know, whether it's their tablets or in print. But it also does, you know, a chance to taste your work without having to dive into a full novel. And so, you know, prior to the Canyons and prior to becoming involved in anthologies myself, like many authors, I just had a few books up on my Amazon page. And now you take a look, and I think we're hitting 40 soon of, you know, either collaborative efforts with Tales, of course. So that's a quarter of them right there. But then, you know, full standalone stories so people can and you know, to be blunt, it improves readership. You know, when people get a chance to see more from you, then they're ideally, if they like what they see, they're going to invest in more of your work.
I just popped your author page up there on the Spilling Ink page, and yeah, it's pretty impressive when you scroll through and see everything with your name on it on there. That's pretty awesome. Well, we are kind of coming up on our 1 hour mark, guys, but I want to get back to Elliot here and let him talk about anything you might want to talk about with his fiction. Anything else you want to chat with people about, Elliot?
I guess I'll add to what Dan was saying before about experimenting on short stories. And I found that's very much the case in the short stories that I've written. So I can almost trace the inception of Young Slasher to a couple of short stories I wrote before. So there's a story called Bang Bang, which was in a anthology called Crime and Punishment, which was very parallel universe kind of bit of a mind. I don't know if I can swear here, bit of a mind stuff. And then for Doomsday, which was the first piece of work I've been in with Daniel, I wrote a kind of horror comedy piece called Mia versus Vegan Cannibals, which is probably has to be the only slapstick comedy in a Doomsday anthology. And it's really just developing your voice, developing the different styles of writing that you like to do. And I can compare my first novel with my current novel, and they're completely different in writing style and voice. And I think short fiction is just a great way to experiment with that. And I've written three stories for Canyon so far. Well, I've written four. There's a fourth one coming out in the Valentine's Day issue. And they're all completely different. There's a couple in the middle that are related, but it goes from science fiction to being straight up horror. And I like to think that I don't really write genre. Dan's taking a photo of me. I don't know. I don't think that I write genre. I'd like people to go, yep, that's definitely an S. Elliot Brandis piece, whether it's horror, whether it's fantasy, whether it's science fiction. And I think if you stick to the characters and you play around the edges with all sorts of slipstream stuff, you end up with something that's really unique and really interesting. And having a good cover helps as well.
Awesome.
Yeah, I know. I'm finding with Young Slasher, it came out of the gates a lot better than other novels I've written. And I think a lot of it is just the cover is appealing to readers of the horror genre, and it kind of hits you in the face, and it stands out amongst the sea of blacks and greys of horror works on Amazon.
Hell yeah, yeah, man. That's, yeah, man. That's an awesome cover.
And I've got an even better one coming up for the follow-up novel, which I haven't shared yet.
Oh, I can't wait for that. Yeah, that's going to be awesome.
But it's brutal, yeah.
Okay, we have a special request from Joshua Pantelaresco, who is an author who's been on our show, and he also does his own indie author podcast. So he wants to hear, I want to be where the people are. I want to see them dancing, walking around on those, what do you call it, feet? Sorry, that's all I know, Josh. I'm sorry. I did my best.
You're just further branding yourself, Little Mermaid.
actually,
we are running at the end of our time here, guys, but you know, I really appreciate you kind of juggling your busy lives, and for you, Brandis, taking a stop in between country hopping to come and hang out with us. But it's been awesome, guys. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, thanks for having us. It's a lot of fun.
I've got one more Little Mermaid story for you before we go, Little Mermaid.
Yeah.
We got to make him a graphic now.
No, Daniel will do that. No, don't say that.
For some reason, there's vans in these countries that, first time I heard it, it was like an ice cream truck tune, went out there, and it was a gas truck, just selling, you know, tins of gas. And the second time I heard it was about a week ago, where it was the Under the Sea marimba kind of music. And we're sitting there, it was a hot day, and we're like, that's got to be an ice cream truck. So we, you know, walk around the corner, follow this mysterious, and it was a garbage truck. they just play the music. So all the shops, they come out with their garbage and chuck it in the back of the truck. So it was the most disappointing day of my life. I didn't get
off. Such a test.
Oh shit. Oh. All right, guys. Well, it's been a fun episode. It's been wonderful chatting with you. Katie, is there anything you wanted to add before we go?
No. I've just been soaking in all the information, especially since we're working on our own anthology right now, just kind of feeling out what we need to do as far as marketing and cover and, you know, just getting it out there.
Well, we're going to
I will say that, Katie, if you want to reach out for marketing, there are a lot of promotional opportunities. Like I said, Canyons kind of rolls on its own, but like Clones and some others, there are some great avenues to go with. And I can't leave without mentioning a great anthology, Uncommon Minds, releases in a few days. Jason happens to have a story in there. I do as well. And we can kind of see how that's marketed. But yeah, feel free to reach out to me, and I'll steer you in a direction.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you again.
Cool. Well, have a great day, guys. Thank you for joining us on Spilling Ink.
Thank you for listening to Spilling Ink.